Good morning. You are listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, and streaming at ksqd.org. This is Community Radio for the Monterey Bay. We're coming to you live from our studio in the Harvey West neighborhood of Santa Cruz. It's Saturday morning, and this is your Saturday morning garden show in the garden. So happy to be here with both Mr. Joe Truscott and Martin Quigley. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning and happy holidays.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving, everybody. It's 42 degrees, so we're getting some chill.
Yeah, I did see the sun kind of coming up into some clouds as I was driving in this morning, but it's still there. We're not quite into the mini ice age yet, but it's finally getting cold, and I'm glad for that because we haven't had a lot of chilling hours. Meaning below 45.
And why is that important, Martin?
Well, it's part of the re-clock setting in the phenology, the sequence of growth and blooming that plants go through. Even in the Mediterranean climate, some plants require a chilling period, whether it's the number of days or hours below freezing or the number of weeks in which it's just plain cold but not quite freezing. Things like lilacs will grow here, for instance, but if you want really good blooms, you have to plant them in a winter where there's snow and ice, and they really like it. And apple trees are right on the cusp.
If you want that Spitzenberg, baby, you got to have 1,200 hours of chilling time.
It's the same way some plants, you know, need a certain amount of heat days to ripen their fruit. When you see on the package, it's from seed to fruit in 60 days or whatever it is. But that's dependent.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Just 60 days.
Yeah, tell my tomatoes that.
Yeah, right. Those tomatoes on the vine always picked green. They somehow turn red. Yeah, there's a reason there aren't apple trees in Vietnam either.
Right.
Yeah, so.
But I'm always surprised here on the Central Coast of the apple breeds that do well here without a freezing period.
Well, there's a couple of varieties that were developed in places like Australia or the Granny Smith or Israel, the Anna. Mm-hmm. I don't know where Dorset Gold was developed, but
England
probably, Dorset. Yeah. But those are like 150-hour chilling varieties. But we digress slightly because apples can be very decorative.
Especially the red and golden ones.
Lady apples, the little ones, and crab apples.
And the golden pippins.
Yes. Oh, well, Cox's orange pippin, that would be one of them. Anyways, using fruit for decorations.
Right, we're going to talk about decorations in a little while, but we want to take it from the top with the Christmas tree,
and
go with the living plants, and then down to all the things you can do with plants, both purchased and from your garden. And
now, I remember a story about the Yule log, and of course, originating in Europe and all of that, but in the South. There was this thing where the servants, or sometimes the slaves, unfortunately, they got to have a holiday for as long as the Yule log burned. Mm-hmm. So they would try to find something that would burn a long time.
And it was not put sideways into the fireplace the way we would do normal firewood. Would be an entire trunk, and they would push it into the fireplace
as it burned
on one end. So you could go for days with that Yule log. Sometimes it lasted a week.
Get that black tupelo, and it's going to, you know, go in the Nisa Silvatica or something.
I've been to some Yule concerts that seem to have lasted.
Damn, just push that log in a little faster.
Not the Nutcracker again, please.
Overly long and under-rehearsed.
Oh, dear.
But anyway, the Yule log was an old European tradition, particularly in the British Isles. And it wasn't until Queen Victoria married Prince Albert, who was German, as was Victoria's immediate ancestry. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he brought the Christmas tree from Germany, where you decorated a tree and put live candles while you were singing the carols.
Oh, Tannenbaum, oh, Tannenbaum.
Stille Nacht and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and that's one of the things from German culture, which became really, really popularized, mm-hmm. starting in the 1860s with the mass German migration out of Europe, all those little kings and queens and duchess and counts and all that. The Germans picked up and left because there were so many wars, and they arrived in the Midwest, which was fertile ground for their Christmas traditions. Mm-hmm. So whether we know it or not, the whole decorated tree and the live tree inside or the cut tree inside is a German tradition.
I would think almost the entire concept of decorating for Christmas and making it into the holiday mm-hmm. that it is, beyond being a religious celebration, that we didn't do any of that stuff until, you know, the Industrial Revolution, essentially.
Yeah. Charles Dickens pushed it around a lot.
Yeah, there you
too.
Go.
Yeah.
Then it was all about the food, the Christmas goose, the special food.
Yeah. Right.
Christmas is coming. The goose is getting fat. Please to put a penny in the old man's hat.
Yes.
If you haven't got a penny, a halfpenny will do. If you haven't got a halfpenny, God bless you.
Yes.
So,
good tunes. Yes,
God has blessed me a lot.
Yes, your halfpennies. Yes, a halfpenny.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So trees. One of the things that I think is important for our listeners and anyone who actually wants to celebrate using this ancient, more or less pagan symbol of evergreen, mm-hmm. And you know, such that. Bringing it in for the winter solstice, that point at time when the shortest night, shortest day and longest night of the year,
right.
The return of the sun cycle. So having that greenery to represent the fertility, the fecundity of spring to come.
And continuity.
And continuity, precisely. So the types of trees that were selected in Europe and the types of trees that may be selected on the East Coast as opposed to the West Coast of the United States, they're going to vary to some degree in terms of their scarcity or availability, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The whole Christmas tree growing industry, it's as big as, if not larger than, the whole poinsettia growing mm-hmm. industry. Mm-hmm. But there are some things to know, some tips and what have you, about the type of selection of tree that you might get based upon what's available in your area, whether mm-hmm. it's the density of it, or let's say you want to have it for fragrance purposes, to bring that wonderful smell into the home.
But sometimes they're not available.
Right.
I think one guiding factor should be if they were harvested locally and recently is a good reason to stay local with your shopping. A lot of the big store and temporary Christmas tree lots are Canadian trees that have been cut starting in September. Mm-hmm. And so they've been bundled up and put in a refrigerator container until December now. And that's one of the reasons all the needles fall off once you warm it up in the house.
Mm-hmm. Well, let a tree dry out once, something like a Doug fir, and you're going to have shatter everywhere. But we might as well give a shout out to the fact that we do have local Christmas tree growers, you know, to grow and cut your own. One of our local supervisors has his own Christmas tree farm for many, many years now.
Yeah. It's a long-term investment, though. Like fruit trees, you have to be prepared to wait. Some of the faster-growing conifers will become cuttable in, say, 5 to 10 years, but you know, the bigger, slower ones, it's really an expensive proposition.
Well, talk to us a little bit about cutting the trees themselves and shaping the tree, because you brought up all these interesting points.
Well, these days, most Americans apparently want to lay the decorations on the outside of the tree, and so the industry has taken to shearing them from a young age, so they look like a cone, but they're very dense, and you can't see through them. Now, the original tradition was with live trees and live candles. Little counterweights would hold the candles upright on the tree, and you had to make sure there was enough space between the branches so that the flames wouldn't reach the branch above.
Set the tree on fire. Yeah.
And people
have a burning bush.
And
that makes perfect sense.
Well, thinning out the trees, too. You can actually cut out.
That's what I do, or did when I had kids at home. You thin out maybe up to a third of the branches so you can see through it, especially with the lights. If everything's on the surface, the tree just becomes a base, and you don't even really see it. But to make the tree really work, you can thin out some of the branches. And Steve and I were just remembering our dads drilling holes in the trunk and taking branches out of a thick area and sticking them into the skinny area.
That'll fix it.
So if you had an awkward asymmetrical tree,
you've got that gap on the back.
You could.
You know? It's like, Yeah.
But you can do that. Most people end up cutting their Christmas tree when they get home, especially the ones who have 8-foot ceilings and bought a 12-foot tree. And then the question is, do you take off the top?
Or
where does the angel go?
Yeah, well, you got to put that star up there or something. I put an owl on top of mine, to tell you the truth, but I'm a little more
remember,
pagan in my
you're allowed to do a lot of pagan things because the winter solstice was a very, very important marker in the year of pre-literate societies. The day lengths alone would tell them that the spring was coming. So decorating a tree, it could be with animal furs or God knows what these days. I mean, the thematic tree has become a big thing since the 1950s. You know, lots and lots of ornaments. Old-fashioned ornaments, the glass ones, the blown glass balls, the ones that, you know, your little sister broke every year trying to hang them up.
Well, one of the most fascinating places I visited was in Nuremberg, Germany, the Christkindlmarkt, where ornaments galore of the hand-blown glass variety and hand-painted, et cetera, et cetera. Just wonderful. I've got a few. You know,
Well, they're heirlooms, and people do have heirloom, you know, the creche scene, you know, the cradle and the manger, all that. Ours were many, many years old, somewhat eaten by dogs here and there, and that becomes – I made a little bundle of grass when I was 3 years old into a palm tree, and that little – decaying bundle of grass came out year after year, along with the lice.
Nice traditions.
My mother had quite a collection of Santa Clauses made out of a toilet paper roll with red construction paper and cotton glued onto them. We finally said, you know, Ma, it's time.
Burn them?
The pine cones with glitter.
Yeah.
When I asked too many questions in Sunday school, I was always put in the back of the room and said, Stephen, here, just put glitter on these pine cones and shut up.
Well, Elmer's glue all over the table and glitter all over the house.
Well, okay, so Christmas trees, there are a number of varieties that are very, very fragrant. The firs, Abies, Balsamia, the balsam fir is a very fragrant one. Fraser fir can be found here on the West Coast. There are some East Coast varieties, Canaan, I think it is, you're not going to find that here.
And firs have generally open structure, which makes them good for through decorating. You can bring the light through the middle and not just on the outside.
And of course, when I lived up in the mountains, we had white fir.
And pines.
Well, the Monterey pine as a Christmas tree, are you familiar with the story about how they got shipped to New Zealand for production, where in New Zealand, Monterey pine, Pinus radiata, has like two known pests, whereas here in California, where they're native to our Central Coast region of California, it's just three specific sites, they have like 88 known insect pests and about 102 disease type pests. And what we suffered through in, I guess it was the early 90s until the aughts, was the pitch pine canker, which was vectored around by beetles. And the theory is that we got all of these trees that were shipped in from New Zealand as little potted, you know, Christmas tree things that people then planted into their yards that were completely susceptible. They had no resistance to these particular diseases, which our local trees have developed. They're not, you know, foolproof in terms of getting pitch pine canker. But so the migration of trees, another European variety that you'll often see the local nurseries will be growing and selling for the table piece or, you know, the small apartment type tree potted living, is the Italian stone pine, Pinus pinea, which those you can plant out into your garden.
Well, but be careful. They tend to fall over when they're big.
And the umbrella pine. That's also the pine from which you get your pine nuts, or it's one of them.
Right.
So just to be clear, what are the kinds of pines that people are going to find at the big box stores sitting out as a live tree shaped for Christmas?
Yeah, most commonly.
What are they going to be most commonly?
I would say the Pinus pinea, Monterey pine would be probably number two. What do you think, Martin? Beyond the pines, the firs, you might, you know.
Doug fir.
Yeah,
what's the difference between a pine and a fir?
Well, the pine have longer needles and clusters, and firs and mostly the other conifers firs and spruces have individual needles, which, of course, are leaves, actually. So the pines tend to be a little more awkward to decorate with those big needles. Right. And then when they shear them, you have these little stumps all over it, too. So it doesn't look very handsome.
There are cedars also.
Yeah, and they look softer, which are very nice.
Very softer. They're much, unless you're talking something like a blue Atlantic, you know, Cedrus Atlantica, Glauca, or the Colorado spruce.
Does the cedar smell like cedar wood?
They do.
They do, yeah.
Yeah, they
absolutely
do. But remember, the smell stops after the tree gets acclimated in the house and it's not fresh anymore.
Sending out the resins.
Right. And, of course, that's when you take twigs off and burn them over the dining room table.
That's another one of our pagan ceremonies.
Fire's good.
Absolutely. Okay, so there are all kinds of trees, and there are the living ones and the cut ones. Obviously, we're not going to try and plant the cut one out in the yard. It's just not going to grow. But the living trees.
The living trees, it's a very nice idea that you don't have to kill a tree in order to bring it in and enjoy it for a week or a month, or 7 months in case of some friends of mine, until it's a bare twig. But the living trees, there's a caveat that sometimes they've already gone into dormancy outside. Then you bring them into, you know, if they're growing out in a field even, I mean, it's potted. But if you bring them inside the house, all of a sudden that warm temperature, you know, breaks their cycle.
Right.
And especially if you keep them for more than a couple of weeks inside the house and then put them back out in the cold, they can be severely shocked.
Yeah. I haven't noticed this here, but back in Ohio, there were quite a few farms that had these wonderful rows of living spruce trees, mostly, purchased at every Christmas and then planted in the spring when the ground was done.
Yeah.
So you got these rows of varying heights
trees.
as the trees went. I've never seen that out here.
But in Ohio and back in the East, you know, you couldn't go out and plant them because the ground was frozen. Mm. You had to, you know, keep them in a cool shed somewhere until...
The other sort of a caveat I would say is that sometimes you're going to find a tree, or you'll see a tree in a nursery, a living tree, that's just so gorgeous and you think, oh, you know, this would make a great Christmas tree. But even though it's sitting in a pot, check to make sure it hasn't been, you know, ripped out of the field and it's what's, you know, the burlap and ball or ball and burlap situation where the roots have been cut and it's been wrapped up. And
explain that a little bit because I'm not sure people understand.
So for larger specimens for a living tree, some of the nurseries that grow the trees in the field, they will then dig them out of the ground and wrap them up in burlap to keep them
entwine or wire,
and that will keep them secure, the root ball from falling apart. They generally weigh a ton also, but keeps it moist until planting. Well, that's fine if you're purchasing a tree to be putting into the ground immediately for a landscape project or something to get it to grow. It's quite a different thing if you're going to be bringing it into the house for the you know, the holiday season and then trying to get it back out and get it planted. The failure rate is very high, is what I'm trying to say.
I would say almost 100%.
You mean they'll die?
Well, yeah. The roots have been exposed and dried out.
Yeah.
It's a dry, warm house. And then you put them out and it's cold, but their roots are still, you know, cut and...
It's reminiscent. I don't know why this is
so
popping
what,
in my head.
What can people do to avoid that if they get
keep
one
it moist.
Keep it moist and keep it outside
like
as long as possible.
Like put it in a big washing tub or something?
Or a bucket, and I hope your Christmas tree skirt is big enough to hide the damn thing because it can be quite
cumbersome. And don't leave it in, you know, don't put it in on Thanksgiving Day and take it out at New Year's.
Or Valentine's Day.
Or even, worse.
just leave it there.
Yeah.
It's so pretty.
There are trade-offs. You know, there are some companies, and there is one locally as well, who rent living trees.
Mm-hmm.
So you rent the tree for the holiday, and then
they come and take it away.
They come and take it away afterwards. And
it's
they
like
take
all
care
the interior plant services. That's one of the specialties.
Sure. I have done that with some of my balsam firs in the past.
Also, if you do have a living tree of any size, from tabletop to, you know, front hall, you should not spray that fake snow stuff on it. Or anything that's going to stick to it, because that will dry out the leaves and lead to its earlier death.
Okay, well, we're eating up a lot of time here
on
trees. Let's talk. And what popped into my head that I thought was so funny when we talked about the stick in a pot is poinsettia. Oftentimes, will be sold it's not actually a living plant. It's just stems that have been cut and stuck into oasis cubes, and they're hydrated for a while, mm-hmm. but they're not a living plant.
No, but you can. Most of the poinsettias are in potted in some kind of soil medium, and they can last for a long, long time. Remember, those red things are not petals; those are leaves. Mm-hmm. The flower of the euphorbia is very small and yellow, and it's that's that center of what looks like a giant red flower. Now, they're from northern Mexico, and a Colonel Poinsett, American army guy, saw them in Mexico, and you, even in San Antonio, Texas, you can see them in people's yards, 10 feet tall, long, leggy stems, but they are spectacular when they bloom. And inside, sometimes they will hold those red leaves for months and even years. They go into kind of a stasis because normally all the leaves would drop off.
Yeah, but I mean, people's backyards, I mean, there are some people with the right location.
If you have a south-facing wall, I mean, as a kid growing up on the
peninsula. Without the wind.
Yeah, no, we kind of an enclosed environment. And a neighbor of mine down the road in Prunedale talked about how her mother used to grow poinsettia in the yard. And, I mean, they're not going to be like the trees that you would see in Mexico.
Right.
But if you have it up on a wall, it'll espalier a little bit, and they can survive.
Are they light sensitive? So
they're photoperiod. They're photoperiod specific.
And if you want them to bloom again, and it's in the house or in the office or wherever it is, you have to make sure it's not getting artificial light, lamp light, because they need more than 12 hours of darkness in order to start the bloom.
With poinsettia production in a nursery setting, where we would take our cuttings in July, root them, grow them on, if we left them to their own devices, they would all ripen and be ready for sale at Halloween. So we would specifically put them into lighted greenhouses to extend that light period.
Not light all night, but just adding several hours.
Keeping it at around 12 hours steady. And then as we wanted them for first Thanksgiving and then Christmas, we would pull out full sets into darkened greenhouses or where it was just the normal light patterns. So
That would make them go red?
That's a trigger. Yeah. It's the same way chrysanthemums, all the fall blooming flowers in the garden are triggered by shortening days after, June 21st, the days start getting shorter. It doesn't seem that way for a couple of months, but that is a real trigger in the phenology of these fall blooms.
And now, of course, we have all of these cool colors. We've got, white and plum pudding.
And there's enough of a change down in Mexico and Baja, where they're from, that it will bloom down there.
Sometimes it's a matter of minutes rather than hours.
Yeah, the equatorial regions where you're going to get 12 and 12 all the time,
don't have that phenology. But in the temperate zones, the coming of lengthening the days in the spring and the shortening of days in the fall is what signals the change for the plants.
The other part is temperature, where they're not going to thrive below 48 or 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Right. So keeping them warm, that was one of the biggest problems, or expenses, I should say, in terms of commercial production.
I would imagine,
We, in 2004, 2005 dollars, we had a monthly PG&E bill of $50,000 just to keep, of course, we're talking
huge acres.
800,000. Well, that was 30 acres, 800,000 square feet.
As part of the trade. So are they mostly grown now in the warmer parts of the United States and shipped north?
Almost all greenhouse. It doesn't matter where. No, you can create the environment as long as you're willing to pay the price. The other thing is that unlike a tree growing in a nursery, they're far less forgiving when it comes to their pest problems, whether it's, they get everything, every kind of insect, every kind of fungus and disease. So thousands of dollars are spent spraying them. It's a heavy. I know that Cornell University did a study years ago on trying to grow organic poinsettia.
Forget it.
No, there was no return.
Are there any dangers of bringing these commercial poinsettias in the house if they've been sprayed so much?
No,
as long as you're not eating them.
It's on the leaves, or it's decomposing. I mean, a lot of the pesticides break down pretty quickly.
And no, they will not kill you if you eat them or kill your animals.
But remember,
Diefenbachia,
a whole different thing.
I know, but it's gonna have the same sort of an effect, where it's gonna paralyze your vocal cords.
Well, but poinsettias, all euphorbias, sometimes have toxic sap. Yeah. So if your dog or your child is into eating the house plants, you might have a little bit of a problem.
Yeah. Especially it's gonna make you sick
if you get the sap in your eye. it will be
and curiously enough, painful, even though you know the plant, yes, Joel Robert Poinsett brought them to the. He was the first minister in Mexico and brought them in 1850. But you know, the Aztecs were using it for many, many years. It's an antipyretic or anti-fever inducer in terms of medicinal use. Make a red dye from the bracts. There's all sorts of things. Treat acne with the sap.
Just a little sidebar here. I know a lot of people like to decorate their food and their dishes, and they'll be cooking a lot with flowers. Give us about 10 flowers that are just perfect to
you. Well, if you want to dress up your salad, you can always use chrysanthemum petals, any of the daisy type things. And borages are actually blooming now. The beautiful violets. Bright blue violets, but it's wintertime, so they'd have to be greenhouse grown.
Yeah.
What else?
Some of the orchids are.
Orchids are fine, but you can't eat them. I mean, you could.
But they're decorations.
They're just decorations. But I like floral accents on a plate that you can actually use. Calendula is really good.
Calendula works.
Roses, of course.
Citrus flower.
Rose petals.
Yeah.
You wouldn't put a whole rose bud or flower on the plate, but a little ring of petals.
But yeah.
Oh, speaking of roses, remember in your own garden, those fruits, we call them rose hips for whatever reason, but they are wonderful and they last a long time. And to decorate with your own greens from your own shrubbery. I wanted to say when we were talking about trees, if you have a small place, you can do a bouquet of evergreen branches. You don't have to have an actual tree, and that can be a tabletop thing or a fireplace thing.
But the sprays of rose hips, especially if you grow some of those ramblers that have an incredible spray of hips on it.
Or the rugosas have huge hips.
They get a little bit too soft, but the other ones are harder. And that was my decoration for Thanksgiving dinner, huge bouquet of these incredible
They're wonderful.
Hips.
And remember, after Thanksgiving, you can pick them off and dry them and make tea. And it has more vitamin C than an orange does, more than citrus. So that's one of the nice ways to do an organic Christmas. Also, there's the strings of decorations. You can do cranberries and popcorn. And I will warn you, the cranberries are easy to thread, but the popcorn falls apart.
Dissolves.
And it falls off that string and it looks ratty by the time you get it on the tree. So these big gaps. So strings of cranberries.
Will the cranberries actually dry? Will they be okay?
They will. They raisin themselves. Right.
And can you use them afterwards?
But you would mostly. We use fresh cranberries.
Usually the berry. You're talking like the garlands and things that we use to string on the trees. And there are other greenery products you can use, Smilax and things like this, but the less common, I'm afraid, around here. However, a lot of the table settings, you can go out and collect some incense cedar branches.
Lay them
get
on
some
the table.
Toyon berries.
Rosemary thyme.
You don't need to put in water. They're going to be in a house for less than a week probably if they're on your dining table. You can lay out an arrangement that's flat. It doesn't block the view of the turkey or grandma or anything else. And so table arrangements are a great way to do holly decorations, such as holly.
Things that are so strongly fragrant like that, is it because of an oil that they have? And the oil is what keeps the fragrance.
Right, and it's kind of a volatile oil. So sometimes like lavender, it'll be fresh and lovely in smell, but it will start drying out. On the other hand, if you dry it out quickly and put it in a potpourri, rosemary and lavender and a lot of the Mediterranean herbs are great for that.
Okay, we're going to go take a short break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about some of the other holiday plants and traditions, not just Christmas, but Hanukkah and some of these other non-traditional things. So we'll be right back. Stay tuned. And this is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, streaming at ksqd.org. It's In the Garden, your Saturday morning garden show. I'm Stephen E. Pop, and I'm here with Martin Quigley and Joe Truscott, and we're having quite a lively conversation about plants for decorations for the holidays. Now, what sorts of plants would you think would be adequate for Hanukkah, say?
Well, the Hanukkah theme tends to be blue and white as opposed to the Christian red and green. And so you can get early forced irises as cut flowers. There are several things you can do. Dutch iris, carnation, white carnations, white chrysanthemums.
Senecio, Cinerarias. Cinerarias. We're one of the ones that we did as a potted item quite mm-hmm. frequently. And then there's the blue or silver foliage, right? The eucalyptus seeded yuke or
the baby blue.
So baby blue, yeah.
That's really, really nice. And you can add those to greens. You don't even really need to find white if you find some
blue. If you want to go tacky, there's blue carnations.
There are blue poinsettias, too. And did you know we do orange poinsettias for Halloween now? We call them frankenpoints.
I forbid it. No, they're so awful. When they spray paint flowers, it's the same way as they spray paint the little succulents in the big box stores.
Right.
Or they dip them in some gluey color. But anyway, don't get the artificially colored flowers. The absorption dyes are a little bit better, but they make the petals last shorter. I mean, they dry up fast. Mm. So you can find natural flower colors. Blue is a little iffy at Christmas time, but you can get some.
A little less common, but no, I mean, it's there. Borage is winter flowering usually as well.
And borage looks great on a salad. Blue flowers are bright blue, and they're totally edible.
In soup or in cheese. And
Rosemary also has blue.
That's
blue-ish.
True. Yes.
Someone say lavender.
Oh, it's not lavender. It's bluer than lavender.
Oh, dear.
Cerulean.
Teacher, please come.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, how about some other plants that are red and green?
Well, there's kalanchoe, or as some people say, calancho, and those are for sale in all the plant stores and box stores now.
Another photoperiod sensitive item.
Right. Yeah. They're brilliant red flowers. They also have orange and white and yellow now.
And have you seen the larger flowered variety? They call them calandrinas. They have even larger flowers than the regular kalanchoe will have. It's a cross of some sort. Very interesting. A couple of the, Trader Joe's has sold a lot of those. And yeah, you can get pinks, hot pinks, but we're talking Christmas, so reds and whites are definitely common.
Right.
I guess, you mentioned mums. Definitely those can happen.
And they can last for a long time. If you change the water and cut them every couple of days, they can last.
Before we get off the cut flower thing, if someone sends you some cut flowers, don't be afraid of aspirin in the water, because it's a willow-based
salicylic acid.
And it will give them a little bit of
keeps them from getting a headache.
But it also keeps them from sealing up their little cells down near the cut region, so the water will be absorbed faster.
Yeah.
But we also didn't mention anthurium, which are brilliant red. They're the big heart-shaped, waxy-looking. It looks like one huge petal, but it's not really a petal.
It's got a little spade,
and then the spadix, the little phallic symbol that's.
And we haven't talked about the amaryllis.
Bulb amaryllis.
Oh, aren't they wonderful?
Yeah, they are. Those crazy red lions.
It's a treat for the whole family. Watch it. You get the bulb. It's packed with a little bit of peat moss, and it comes from Holland, usually, the big bulb-growing industry center. And they have already been stratified, that is, they've been given the right temperatures. And amaryllis come from South Africa, and they bloom after the fire. And like the naked ladies that we have here, they have a cycle where the leaves come up, do all their business, then the leaves die down, and then the flower buds come up. So you get this pot, sometimes it's a container, or you can put it over water in a container. And in a couple of weeks, the stem will grow 12, 16, 20 inches tall and have red or pink or white trumpets.
So the bulbs that you're getting on an amaryllis is actually at that point in its growth cycle where it wants to send up the flower
first,
not the green.
Right.
Oh, I never really realized that.
Sometimes they'll start putting up leaves while the flower stem is growing, but normally it's just that flower coming out of a naked bulb. And speaking of bulbs, paper whites, narcissus are a really good one. And they're easy to get. I mean, even at Costco, they have.
Okay, now correct me if I'm wrong. You either love it or hate it when it comes to the fragrance.
Very powerful smell.
I can't stand them.
Outside, definitely.
In the indoor, I mean, it's great for kids. You can take the bulbs and put them in a little tray with some gravel and water and watch them,
bloom. Watch them fall over when they get tall.
But they're
intense fragrance, and you don't have to. You can put them in the other room for the night.
Yeah. Those are also very easy to transfer into your garden after they bloom.
Oh, yeah.
That's not a problem. But What about the amaryllis? I've never had any luck.
I have pots of amaryllis from Christmas past, and they all bloom in the summer.
But you keep them in pots. You don't put them in the
Again, as Martin is fond of telling us all the time about the dormant period for a lot of these bulbs, and when you get these things from the nursery or from Holland, you'll notice that
from your relatives.
Yeah, so. Well, you'll notice that pot has no drain holes in it. So during the period of time,
it's a vase, not a pot.
It's right, exactly. That would be. In fact, I even saw some recently where the bulb was wrapped or sealed
in wax. A thick coating of wax.
A thick coating of wax.
And that bulb has enough water in it to go through the whole bloom cycle.
But when it's done, you got to put it in something that'll have drainage.
Well, you got to take the wax off too.
Yeah, yes.
But remember that the flower is a huge expenditure of energy for that bulb.
Right.
If it doesn't get water, it's depleting the resources in the bulb, and it might not transplant. They need to go dormant a little bit too. So cut the flower head off and lay that bulb in a dry, warm place, a dry, cool place. And then pot it up in, say, March or April.
And so tell us about the ones that you've had for years.
They bloom in the middle of summer before the naked ladies do. And
so they adjust to the,
cycle.
They go back to their natural cycle.
And their flowers are just as big as the commercial ones. I thought they'd be smaller, you know, the way sometimes second and third generation blooms go. But no, they're spectacular. And, you know, over the years, I've had five or seven in a single pot. And rather than just a single bulb, having a whole, you know, pot full of them is amazing.
So practical. They put out bulbets around the
They do make stem? Bulbets. But I'm talking about adding new bulbs every year.
Just
expanding your collection.
And it's a great Christmas gift, especially for the budding gardener, is to watch that amaryllis grow. Now, paper whites need a little support. They're tall, and they get top-heavy when they bloom, and then you have to watch out. Hyacinths are a nice one. They make little hyacinth glass vases that hold the bulb at top so that the roots go into the water, and that's it, no soil. And they're also intensely fragrant. Some people can't handle those. But
oh, I'd love that.
The colors are great, pink, blue, and white. And now they have some other.
And they easily, after they bloom, easily put into the ground. Yeah. And they do well here on the coast.
They do.
So when it comes to these narcissus, these paper whites, and there's other species, obviously the daffodils and what have you, in the garden themselves, paper whites, in my own past experience, actually will, they bloom that first time, but then they're not going to bloom for a little while after that in the garden. They might bloom that first season, but they need more attention, I think, than your daffodil does. Even the daffodils, you need to lift and divide every so many years. Mm-hmm. They get cramped or, you know, crowded in there.
Well, it's true that the first year after being a houseplant or used as that energy. They've used up the energy they need to regain some strength and some thickness. But I've got pots now where the paper white foliage is 3 inches above and growing every day. And so they'll be blooming probably in January. So depending on when you actually start watering the dormant bulbs, you can time for when your blooms will appear.
So are you going to do a tree this year, guys?
I am not.
I have a package up in the attic.
Oh,
I pull it up.
You call it a tree.
Put it out, and I stick it in, and it's in the picture window in the living room, and all the neighbors don't think I'm weird because I am celebrating in some way, and you know that's important to me.
Well, some people do a Christmas tree outside in the front yard, which is nice, too, if you have a conifer especially, but you can do it with a naked deciduous tree. Just string the lights and put up decorations. Some people, of course, go overboard, but we won't name them here.
I'm of the opinion that it's just as easy to leave the dang things up. So, you know.
No.
I'm ready to go year-round.
There's a word for that. I won't bring it up now.
Lazy?
But one of the caveats on putting strings on outside trees, if you use the lights, you might disrupt the day length dictum.
That can happen.
That can happen with trees under street lights. You see that they want to drop their leaves, but they can't because the days haven't been short enough. Yeah. And so you'll see a halo of trees, of the branches on a tree where the leaves are still on even in midwinter.
And it's because of streetlights.
The streetlights keep the abscisic acid from letting the leaf drop off.
Oh, that's absolutely fascinating.
Well, that's true, but especially in areas where it snows, it means broken branches because those leaves will then catch the snow and the weight will break the branch that it's on. But anyway, we don't have to worry about snow here. Our biggest enemy in the garden in the so-called winter, in our rainy season, is just that cold, wet period when many things are really not happy, especially the desert and some of the Mediterranean things. If they sit wet, they're going to suffer. And so we'll probably be mentioning this again, but when the rains are here in full and you have outdoor pots, especially with succulents, you really should lay them on their side. Mm-hmm. And it sounds crazy and it looks a little funky, but get a piece of cardboard so you don't break the pot when you lower it down. You don't have to pick them up. You just lay them over, and then when it starts to dry up in April or whenever, then you can stand them up again. But I've killed agaves and aloes, which are ironclad plants, by having them in pots where they stayed wet.
I was mentioning to Joe before the show that my Cymbidium orchids, I have completely forgotten to move them out of the rain or anything this year. And, of course, I went to look at one of the larger pots and realized there's no soil in the pot anymore.
Anyway, so, it ate it all up.
Yeah, it did. So it's not really rotting. It's okay. Yeah. The water just runs right through.
Speaking of Cymbidiums, though, my first buds are showing. Uh-huh. The bud spikes are coming
off.
This is when they get their fertilizers.
Well, the early rain is just...
Warm temperatures. I mean, we're still getting these nice daytime temperatures.
Yeah, exactly. And, boy, the oxalis and everything else is coming alive again. Martin's very proud of eliminating it from his garden.
Well, guess what?
Of course, he's just telling us how much his legs hurt.
Yeah, exactly.
You're kind of misshapen because of that hill, you're
That's
walking.
Right. I have one leg is shorter than the other.
I think so. Oh, dear.
Anyway, it's holiday season. We're here to encourage you to have living things around you in your house. Houses become so sterile. And there are plenty of things that do well indoors. Mm-hmm. One of my big projects this year was to create, this is for a fundraising project, I had a heart-shaped box, and I filled it with succulents. And I've taken advantage of the last month of beautiful weather to have it out in the sun. Mm. And I was just struck. I might bid on it myself, even though I'm
the colors develop.
It's incredible. Yeah, it absolutely filled in every spot that was kind of open.
Remember?
And I have this beautiful thing.
Succulents, like sun and drought stress, and the colors are much more vivid. If you watch some of your echeverias and some of the sedums, they go dark green or just medium green all rainy season long. And as soon as it dries up and they start getting sun, that's when the reds and the yellows, the anthocyanins.
And purples and grays.
And isn't a certain amount of that also just stressing them out? Not giving them too much fertilizer, not giving them too much water.
Only fertilize once a year when the rainy season comes, and that's it.
Cold weather will sometimes create russeting on certain plant items or fruits and other things, but generally speaking, the succulents that should be ironclad, as you say, and pretty much fail-proof, just don't love them to death.
And don't overwater. Once again, if you think it needs it, it doesn't. That's why they're succulents.
Well, I hope that everyone has here on the Central Coast and beyond to our wide-flung listeners, we'll have a happy holiday however you celebrate, whether it's Christmas or it's Hanukkah or it's winter solstice. Or
something pagany.
the pagany thing or Kwanzaa or all of the other potential holidays of this period. Mm-hmm. It's a great time to remember to come together with family or friends or relatives, however you can do it, however you like to do it.
Plants just bring joy to the house.
And gratitude.
And if they're taken care of, they will live longer than many of us.
Gardeners live longer than those who don't as well. That's a certain, unless of course you're using heavy equipment, but that's another story.
So. No, I just love those stories of, the bristlecone pine tree.
Yes. 4,000 years old. Yeah. Yes. It looks its age.
It looks its age, but it's still hanging in there.
But it's true that people who garden always have something good to look forward to.
I think so too. And we just want to thank all of you for listening. We will be back here live in the studio again next Saturday with we don't know what, but it'll be fun.
And, you know, that's an interesting comment there, Stephen. If you have questions, if you have programs, if you know people that you think would be great to have on the show, let us know.
That's right.
Mean, we are open.
We will get you on. You've written a book. You got a program. You're teaching a class. Let us know. Redwood trees are nice little trees to bring inside,
or
too.
Or sprouts, the water sprouts.
Things that you can get at the airports as you're leaving California.
Okay, I haven't heard about that. That's that sounds like somebody's black market there. I'm not sure. Okay.
No, San Francisco airport.
All right. Listen, we got to go, but thank you so much for listening. And as we always like to say, until next Saturday, happy gardening. We'll be back. All right. Stay tuned.
Bye-bye.